The heavenly sound of the temple choir opening this introduction to the oral archive of the Inner Temple. The history of the inn dates back to the 14th century, when the Knights Templar were, well, let's say, persuaded to give up their so-called new temple, its church and lands, and we lawyers moved in. Sad to say, the 1300s were not noted for their technology, digital or otherwise, and by the time the Archive Committee had made its case for the funding of this project, the farthest back we could go was to the 1930s and this description of the temple as it was before the Second World War from Master Monier Williams.
They were lovely old buildings. They were grubby and sooty. There were little courtyards which have now vanished. Elm Court, Fig Tree Court, the beautiful 18th century front of Crown Office Row, the old hall and the library, wonderful Victorian building. Both were, in fact.
And both, of course, were destroyed in the Blitz, leaving nothing but ruins for the child who was Jane Lloyd to play in when her family moved back to the temple immediately after the war.
The whole of Crown Office Row was a ruin, and Harcourt buildings. And because when I met my friends, we had a wonderful time playing in the ruins, although, of course, perhaps wasn't the safest thing to do, but they were complete rubble. And we used to make houses in the cellars of what had been the Inner Temple Hall. So I do remember it as a complete waste site, really.
But that didn't stop life going on in the inn, and the absence of most of its principal buildings wasn't going to stop the likes of Roy Beldam upholding dining tradition in the 1950s.
The hall was the Niblett Hall, because the inn, the inn's main dining hall had been bombed during the war. It was in the process of being rebuilt. And students used to dine, and barristers used to dine, in the Niblett Hall, which was a smaller, much smaller building. It was between King's Bench Walk and Sergeant's Inn, if my recollection's right.
And if Jane Lloyd's recollection is right, there was another structure just south of there, which is no longer with us.
My brother and I shared a bedroom, and outside the bedroom was this huge water tank, which is now the car park. That I do remember because we got bitten very badly in the summer by mosquitoes until they drained the tank and demolished it.
Oh, you said there was a tank. Where was that
exactly? It was right opposite, between King's Bench Walk and Paper Buildings. That was to do with the war, or the water. They probably needed watering for the fires. I don't know, I can't remember the history behind that. But there was this, it was obviously full of dirty water because the mosquitoes loved it.
But health hazards outside were not the only things which the early post-war residents had to endure. What accommodation there was available left a little to be desired, as the newlyweds Joseph and Elizabeth Butler Sloss were to discover.
We got married in 1958 and we had nowhere to live, and we asked the inn if they had anywhere. They had a flat where the bath was in the bedroom and nobody really wanted it. And they promised to give us a partition between the bath and the bed.
Master Butler Sloss confirms that the accommodation did improve after that, and she is, of course, still resident in the inn today. In her recording for the archive, she took us back in time to the start of her career at the bar and was able to contrast the difficulty of getting pupillage and tenancy today with her own experience in the 1950s.
In those days, it was easy to become a pupil because you paid, easy to become a tenant because you paid.
Because you paid 100 guineas to be a pupil, personally, I didn't feel there was any difficulty about it.
Roy Beldam, sharing the young Elizabeth Haver's experience of getting on the first rung of the ladder to the bar. But just how long would it take to recoup that sort of initial outlay? Well, Master Beldam recalls for us the early days of his practice at the criminal bar.
You would go to quarter sessions and sit in court and wait. Some people would arrive at court with a guinea, in which case you got what was called a dock brief, in which they would select you from the group of people who were waiting, and say, I'll have him. Then you would go and see him and represent him in his case for a guinea.
Why a guinea?
Well, this was the traditional fee. All fees were marked in guineas. The barrister got the pound and the clerk got the shilling. The other thing you might get, if you were very lucky, you might get a legal aid brief, which involved at least £3, 5, and 6, and that was big money.
Big money indeed. So just 100 of those dock briefs and your pupillage would be paid off. It will take a little more than that to pay off the sort of debts the 21st century Inner Temple student barrister is getting into to fund their studies. But if the sums of money involved in the profession have changed over the years, getting to know the right people is still important, right from the start of your career, as student Samantha Gould has learned.
I was very lucky to get in touch with the judge, His Honour Judge Tonkin, who's just been made a bencherette in her, and he lives in the village that I live in back at home.
But to get the best introductions, it's clear from Samantha's archive entry that you still have to be outstanding in your field, if you'll forgive the pun.
My mum happened to meet him in a field, taking the dog for a walk, and mentioned that I fancied perhaps becoming a solicitor or a barrister. This is when I was only about 15, and perhaps he could give me some direction. He let me marshal him for a month or so. It was brilliant. It was definitely the start of my calling to be a barrister.
Adam Fellows, currently the president of the Inner Temple Students Association, had an equally random encounter which helped him make his choice of inn.
What made this inn stand out for me was when I was looking around at the inn, a couple of barristers who were sat on the Pegasus Terrace said, "You lost?" I said, "Actually, no, I'm looking to become a member of an inn. I just wanted to look around." And the two gentlemen concerned, unfortunately, I can't remember their names, invited me to join them. And so after several glasses of very nice wine, I decided to join this inn.
So, having joined for the wine, he clearly stayed for the food. And the education, of course, which today, as in yesteryear, includes guidance on how to behave in court. In Master Le Cain's early years in practice, how you behaved out of court was equally important.
The wearing of hats was almost universal in those days. And the hats were all bowlers or Homburgs. And that used to give rise to one terror when you unstarted. Of course, the judges used to come walking through the inn to their lunch, or for one reason or another. And if any barrister passed the judge, the convention was he lifted his hat. And the judge, unless he was rather rude, acknowledged this. Now, of course, when you started and you weren't practising in the High Court at all, you didn't know the judges by sight. So I can remember it used to be a terror. If I go walking through the temple now, I shall probably pass a lot of judges, and I shan't know them, so if I don't lift my hat, they'll think I'm very rude.
Ah, those hats. They were still in vogue in the 1960s, when Henry von Blumenthal was a young boy growing up in the inn and watching the barristers go about their business and leisure.
There was a thing that was quite striking. They would open the gates for lunch, and all the barristers who in those days wore bowler hats would walk all together up and down across the green from the slope at the top to the river end at the bottom. And then they'd turn round and walk back, and this was understood to be their sort of lunchtime constitutional. They all did it, hundreds of them sometimes. And then, because of this habit, you could see the awkward bit for them in their nice shoes was the slope. So one day, diggers arrived and started to dig up the turf there, and before long they'd built that white stone staircase, and that was in order to enable the barristers all to walk down and start their promenade. And, of course, the bowler hats have gone, and so I think as a promenade, mostly people just go in and sit down.
And the promenade isn't the only thing that's gone over the years. Henry also remembers how members of Hall were once called to dinner by a differently bedecked member of staff.
Bennett the porter was never seen without his frock coat, and, if I remember right, a top hat. And he could be seen every evening walking from where he lived, at the bottom of Paper Buildings, just by number one, walking up the steps and across the road, and then shortly after that he'd emerge with the horn, which he would blow for dinner. And he once told me that he always was careful to blow the horn because the previous porter, Pink, had been accepting the half-crown payment for blowing the horn and not actually blowing it, and somebody had complained.
Well, while that tradition lives on only in memory, one which remains in place and has now been recorded for posterity is the silver count. In January of this year, Master Deeby, the master of the silver for the past 20 years, explained the origins of the so-called silver count.
The count, strictly speaking, is for the purpose of the handing over from one treasurer to the next. And it's counting to see that all the stuff should be there is there. And so to speak, the future treasurer signs for it as to what he's taken and has to deliver up at the end of his thing. That was the origin of it.
And what was an annual event is now conducted twice a year, with every piece of silver owned by the inn being taken out of its cupboard by the plate man, William Gallagher, and examined by our adviser, Richard Parsons. Mind you, recording a sound archive of a count of treasures being conducted within crashing distance of the preparations for lunch in hall can pose problems, as you'll hear when Master Deeby tried to show me one of our prize pieces.
This is called the Sherlock Cup. If you look at them, on one side is the Pegasus, on the other side is the Lehrman flag, which ought to spell inner and middle temple to anybody. It was in fact a cup which was given to the master of the temple, Sherlock.
That's a different kind of silverware, yes, being thrown about in the kitchen.
William, is that you?
There was more of a hush than a crash in the air when the director of music, James Vivian, showed me around the inner workings of the temple church organ, powered by its own hissing bellows.
Those pipes are 32 feet long and provide the sort of base of the organ. And we also have some pipes that are only really the length of somebody's fifth finger, and they produce tiny noises up here. I don't know if you're catching that.
Yes, I was, and a lot more besides. Recording for generations to come the sound of the organ before its extensive restoration, which will be carried out over the next couple of years. It was another church sound which brought the temple to the attention of Cynthia Langdon Davis.
The main thing I knew about it was the choir, because that was world famous, and my parents had always had recordings of the famous Hear My Prayer, the Ernest Lough record-breaking record. I think still holds the record for the number of copies sold, and it was marvellous. I can remember my parents having the record, and everybody in those days had it, and it was world famous, and that was how I knew about the temple. I didn't know about the lawyers. I knew about the music.
Well, Cynthia found out a great deal more about the inn and is now one of our longest residing tenants, and she remembers back to the 1960s, a time when the temple was an idyllic place to bring up children.
After 6 o'clock, when the barristers used to go, they didn't work the hours they do now, funnily enough. When they'd all gone home, then the prams used to come out and the roller skates and the children took over. And there were lots of children. I think it was in some ways safer as the world was. And, for instance, prams could be left out in Fountain Court with babies in them. And I can remember a friend of ours, the Darlings, he became treasurer for a bit of Middle Temple, Gerald Darling, and their daughter was a contemporary of ours. I do know that when she was a baby, she'd be left in her pram in Fountain Court with a notice on the pram simply saying, "Please do not feed Fiona." And I don't think they would do that now.
Well, you think they'd feed her anyway. But food is only one of a child's needs. And in the past, the temple's education remit has extended to providing on-site nursery education for resident children, as Elizabeth Butler Sloss told me.
It was started before me by Sue Darling in the Middle Temple, and she asked with, I think, somebody called Mrs. Abrahams, who I didn't really know, and she, Sue Darling, asked the then master of the temple if they could use the vestry for a small group of children, and he said yes. And we employed a very nice woman who was a Christian socialist and believed that barristers were dreadful people, and it was her duty to look after these darling children who had the misfortune to have such terrible parents. She was the most wonderful nursery teacher.
but the legendary Mrs. Willer Brock did have a sensitive side to her. And that, as Master Butler Sloss explained, led to a clash with the other children who occupied the Temple Church rooms.
We had a fracas with the choir boys. She was, as I said, a very devout Christian socialist with a marked lack of sense of humour. And the choir boys found this out, and they left unsuitable messages for her with bad language. And she eventually came to me and I think to Rachel Waller and said she couldn't take this anymore. So we then moved to the drill hall of the Inns of Court regiment in Lincoln's Inn.
All because of the choir boys?
All because of the choir boys.
How very unchristian of them.
It was terribly funny. And our difficulty was we couldn't keep a straight face.
Well, there are laughing matters aplenty in the first recollections which form the preliminary archive of the oral history of the Inner Temple. But there are also memories of momentous events in the inn's history, like Master Monier Williams' recollections of how he came to have Mahatma Gandhi posthumously reinstated as a member of Hall.
I remember lunching, sometimes dining in Hall, looking at the bench and saying to myself, "Oh, I wonder if it's possible to persuade those white-haired old men to bring Gandhi back post-mortem, because I think we should do it." Because there's no doubt in my mind, he was a very, very great man. And so the years passed by. I became a white old man myself and treasurer. And I said, "Well, now is the time I can get Gandhi back to the inn."
And he did. And he tells the tale in disc number one of the Inner Temple Oral Archive, which it is hoped will grow with the years and with the help and cooperation of those of you willing to commit your past and indeed your present to disc for the benefit of future generations. From me, Dara Brehan, for now, thank you for listening.